24 hours a day, 365 days a year.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Northwest Film Center screening of The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T as part of the Cinema Under the Stars program on Thursday, August 7th at 7 p.m. The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T is a musical fantasy film with the story, screenplay, and lyrics written by Dr. Seuss. Before the film, the Grand Style Orchestra will be playing a set of improvisational free jazz music. Again, that's The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, part of the Top Down Cinema series of the Northwest Film Center, on August 7th on the roof of the Hotel Deluxe's parking structure at Southwest 15th and Yamhill. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the album release party for Tribal Essence Volume 2 on Friday, August 8th at 10 p.m. There will be two floors of psychedelic trance and downtempo music curated by DJ Water with performances, art, and special guests. Tribal Essence Volume 2 release party will take place at the Analog Cafe, 720 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information, including a list of performers, can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a local LGBT rights group votes to unionize, making them the latest in a series of nonprofit groups in Oregon that have recently unionized.
We'll get an update on the situation in Gaza, where a ceasefire ended today after Israeli troops killed 10 Palestinians over the weekend.
The U.S. Congress passes a bill to address the problems within the Veterans Administration.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 28th, 2014. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Violence has returned to Gaza after a brief pause in fighting over the weekend. During a 24-hour ceasefire declared by Hamas on Saturday, 10 Palestinians were killed by Israeli airstrikes. Just before the ceasefire went into effect on Saturday, an Israeli airstrike killed 20 members of one family, including 12 small children. On Monday morning, a Palestinian mortar strike killed up to 4 people in southern Israel. Around the same time, an Israeli airstrike hit Gaza's largest public hospital, killing 8 children and 2 adults. Over 1,000 Palestinians have been killed in the last 3 weeks, 80% of whom are civilians. 43 Israeli soldiers and 3 Israeli civilians have also been killed. For the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine, we go to the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, July 28, 2014. At least 10 children were killed, 20 others injured when Israeli warplanes attacked on Monday evening a children's playground near Ashat refugee camp in Gaza City. Shortly after, Israeli jets fired missiles at a Shifa hospital, wounding 5 civilians. On Monday, Palestinian Muslims marked the first day of the Iftar holiday, which marks the end of the holy month of Ramadan. However, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza, 30 civilians were killed on Monday. The death toll has reached 1,076 and more than 6,500 injured since Israel started its war in Gaza on July 8th. The Israeli army claimed in a statement on Monday that the 10 children near Gaza City were killed when a Palestinian shell misfired and hit the playground they were in. Palestinian security forces in Gaza announced that they retrieved parts of the Israeli missile that hit both the playground and a Shifa hospital. IMEMC's Ramil Megari in Gaza.
This is a sort of an indiscriminate Israeli fire that is ongoing here in the Gaza Strip. whether the Israelis have claims or have allegations, have their own pretexts, their own excuses for killing the civilians, it is still the same result, actually. The killing of civilian population of Gaza. The strikes are very bad. For the past hour, for example, we have heard frequent Israeli air strikes on the area. By every second, we have a sound of a shell or a rocket. This is a sort of an apparent escalation by the Israeli military troops amidst the failure of the mediation talks that are being underway by different parties concerned in this world.
At the political level, the United States President Barack Obama and the United Nations Security Council has both called for unconditional ceasefire from Israel on Monday. Their plan is based on an Egyptian proposal that would put a temporary end to the hostilities and would open talks about the future of the Gaza Strip. This includes possible opening Gaza borders. In the West Bank, clashes continued between invading Israeli troops and Palestinian protesters in solidarity with Gaza. Clashes were reported in Hebron, Bethlehem, Ramallah, Nablus, and Jenin. One civilian was injured by Israeli troops' gunfire near Hebron City. Last week, Israeli soldiers killed at least 10 protesters in the West Bank. Moreover, on Sunday late at night and Monday at dawn, 18 Palestinians were kidnapped by Israeli forces across the West Bank, in addition to 5 from Jerusalem area. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, July 28, 2014 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imenc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
On Friday's news, KBOO reported live from a rally in Pioneer Square calling for an end to the Israeli offensive into the Gaza Strip. The Friday protest of around 100 people followed a similar protest the day before, which consisted of 10 times that number. Portlanders came out in a strong show of support for the people of Gaza, who have suffered tremendous civilian losses in the Israeli military attack that began July 8th and has been ongoing since then. During the Portland protest this past Friday, however, several counter-protesters arrived on the scene and tried to shout down the Gaza supporters. One of the counter-protesters brandished a gun and threatened a 9-year-old girl with it before police told him to leave. He was not arrested, nor was he cited for any violation of the law.
Protesters gathered in downtown Portland Saturday to challenge the settlement between the City of Portland and Portland Police Captain Mark Krueger. The protesters marched on City Hall demanding to talk to the mayor and the police chief, Mike Reese, about their decision to accept the settlement. Mark Krueger was paid $5,000 by the city, and 2 disciplinary actions were removed from his record. These 2 disciplinary actions were a suspension for erecting 5 memorials in public parks in honor of 5 German Nazi soldiers. The second disciplinary action removed was a reprimand for retaliation against a female lieutenant. Krueger had harassed the female lieutenant over a period of months in a variety of ways after she sent a text message referring to him as a Nazi. The removal of discipline against Krueger was carried out just days after the mayor of Portland and the chief of police got back from their diversity training at an all-white male retreat. The protesters called the settlement an injustice in a celebration of white supremacy that validates the behavior of Krueger. They presented a list of demands to the mayor's office, which included the removal of Officer Krueger from duty.
The Pacific Green Party announced their opposition last Friday to Oregon's top 2 primary measure, which recently qualified for our November ballot. If approved, the measure would create a top 2 system of general election voting, where the primary ballot allows voters to choose one candidate from all candidates, regardless of political party. The top 2 candidates would then be voted upon in the general election. California and Washington have both adopted the top 2 primary system. For more information, I spoke with Blair Beaubier, spokesperson for the Pacific Green Party.
Blair, the top two primary measure qualified for Oregon's November ballot. What will this measure do if passed?
What this measure will do is severely restrict people's choices in the general election. While the backers of the measure want you to focus on what's going to happen in the primary, the real changes and the real threat is that this will restrict voters' choices in the November general election. Under this top two system, you will only be able to have two choices on the November ballot, and it's very possible that those two choices could either be two Republicans or two Democrats. Top two will generally wipe out all independent and third-party candidates from the general election, and the choices that people will be left with really won't be much of a choice at all. It'll be two candidates who are probably very ideologically similar. So this is an incredible threat to the democratic process and severely restricts people's rights to vote and the choices that they'll have at the general election.
Your party, the Pacific Green Party, has called for Oregon voters to oppose this measure. You're not alone among Oregon's political parties. Actually, quite a few, if not the majority of the major and minor political parties are all against the measure. Who actually is supporting the measure?
I'm not exactly sure who supports this or why they support it or why they think it's a good idea. The fact is that top two has failed miserably in California and in Washington, where it's been used. In California, in the last primary election, California had the lowest voter turnout in its history. So some of the claims of the top two supporters are that this election system boosts voter turnout and gets more moderate elected. And we have seen no evidence of that in California. So not only does this not make any sense, but it doesn't do what its backers say it will do.
Washington, too, also has the top two primary system. But in states that have this system, then we haven't seen an increase in the number of people voting.
No, it has not increased voter turnout at all. Top two does not work the way that its backers say it will. And it causes a lot of vote splitting at the primary election so that the two candidates who eventually make it to the November ballot are not really representative of the districts as a whole. So it really skews things and it doesn't work like the way it's supposed to.
There's one party, the Oregon Working Families Party, has endorsed the measure, and again, they're probably in a minority here of the political parties in the state. They say that the main reason that they endorse it is that the Oregon measure differs from the ones that were passed in California and Washington, and it differs in that it allows parties to officially endorse candidates before the primary, and then that endorsement can be listed on the ballot. Do you see that, and does the Pacific Green Party see that as a way of making the measure more acceptable?
No, it's not acceptable at all. It's just simply not acceptable to limit our choices at the general election. If you look at the spectrum of countries and how many parties they have on the ballot, if you look at countries in Europe and in Latin America, they can have up to a dozen parties on the ballot. You have lots of choices. The United States already offers relatively few choices, and restricting those choices and voices even further is totally unacceptable. I mean, what's the difference between having just two choices on the ballot and just one? Well, there's not a whole lot of difference. So this top two takes us really close to an authoritarian state.
A similar measure was actually on the Oregon ballot in 2008. What happened to that measure at that time?
Well, Oregonians already defeated this by a 2-1 margin back in 2008, and I expect we'll do the same thing again. I really don't know why this is being brought up again.
That was my next question. Why do you think the measure has been revived for this election?
You know, I'm not really sure why this has been brought back. I think one of the problems is that we have people who have no experience with election systems trying to step in and create solutions where there aren't problems. Now, if we want to do something, change our election, I think I'm for changes which result in better representation and more voter turnout. And top two doesn't do it. Top two restricts our choices. It depresses voter turnout. We should really look at something like instant runoff voting, which will eliminate the spoiler problem, give voices to independent and third-party candidates and the people who support them, and it's just a much more democratic way for people to participate.
We've been talking with Blair Beaubier, Pacific Green Party spokesperson, about the top two primary measure which qualified for Oregon's November ballot. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News.
A Clark County commissioner in Vancouver, Washington, has raised a proposal for a new bridge across the Columbia River that would go east of I-205 from Portland to Vancouver. The new bridge would be an alternative to the Columbia River Crossing, or the CRC. The CRC project was plagued with problems and was finally called off completely several months ago after years of negotiations between Oregon and Washington lawmakers. KBOO's Henry Leisha spoke with Sharon Nassett of Third Bridge Now about the new proposal.
What is the proposal that Clark County Commissioner David Mader has put forward for this new third bridge?
Commissioner Mador had on Friday at 6 o'clock in the Clark County Service Building, had a presentation that was put on by Fig Construction Company, and Linda Fig, who is one of the owners of the company, did an outstanding job of coming and talking about what innovative things can be done nowadays with roads, avoiding wetlands, fitting into sceneries, and working with communities. And you can go to cvtv.com, and under their probably would be under their community part of their TV, and watch it on your computer. And most of the presentation talked about, as I said, different ways of conforming with the water and a bridge. And then they did for a little bit talk about what a bridge from 192nd across, I think it was a two-lane Ontario, or freeway, excuse me, and they had it starting at 192nd at Camas on Highway 14, SR 14, and going over to Airport Way, and kind of butting it into that, and then a second extension in the future could go to I-84. They did allow, we had about 18 elected officials that attended, and some of them asked questions having to do with how it could be financed, how it would affect other parts of the corridors. But what it did come out with, Senator Ann Rivers was one of the moderators, and what it came out with was that they needed to look at alternatives and compare that alternative with others, but that Washington State, considering how many elected officials were there, was ready to continue going forward with the project. And what continually was mentioned was that we have fewer bridges in similar sized cities, and that the congestion issues have not only caused economic damage locally, federally, and internationally because of the international highway, but that it also had caused great environmental issues by not having enough adequate transportation for vehicles to move around, and therefore them sitting and causing pollution.
Yeah, so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the differences between your plan, the Third Bridge Now organization's plan. It's more of a west-oriented plan as far as crossing the Columbia, whereas...
The thirdbridgenow.com is a brand-new freeway that attaches to I-5 in the north, going into the Port of Vancouver as a viaduct, removing freight and hazardous material routes from Waterfront Avenue, 4th Plain, Mill Plain, and 39th, and giving Fruit Valley Road and the Port of Vancouver direct freeway access to I-5. As a viaduct, it removes the surface-level traffic and connects the downtown area again, so it's no longer has a river of trucks. Ours goes over Janssen Beach on the west side of the Burlington Northern Rail, and therefore is bare, vacant, and publicly owned land. It continues around Smith and Bybee Lake, skirting the sides of it over to Highway 30, and that alignment from the peninsula, North Peninsula, over to Highway 30 is already in adopted regional transportation plans.
For these ideas of building a third bridge, how likely is it that the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Washington State Department of Transportation will support these plans?
Well, they are already adopted in regional transportation plans in both states. And I talked with the federal transit administrator or highway administrator in our area, Phil Ditzler, a month or so back before as CRC was falling, and said to him, so, you know, do you guys still want to be in the game, or if this is it, are you guys just going to walk away? And he said, no, you still have a congestion problem. If you can get your leaders to say that you want something else in a different location, have them step up. And whether or not the DOTs want to come forward or not, I mean, they're saying things like, you know, we're not going to do anything for years. The congestion is going to get worse, and we're just going to come. Well, you know, that's pretty childish. Not going to help. And to tell you the truth, private-public partnerships can take it quite a ways before we even need the departments of transportation to be involved at all. And that might be best because they seem to be getting a lot of projects wrong in Oregon and in Washington. So by building a consortium of private people and setting up our own committees and going forward, Washington has Dream It, Build It, Fund It, and Oregon has similar types of projects. We don't need to even involve the DOTs until pretty far into it.
So finally, what's public support looking like? How many supporters are we seeing for these kinds of ideas?
Many. A lot of people are thankful that even people that supported CRC, it was kind of like a religion. You had to either support it or you were in trouble. But a lot of people are still saying that there is a big problem with congestion. They would like to see something taken care of, and they're excited to talk with you. I've been meeting with two or three elected officials a week lately, and other people with community organizations, and they're excited about seeing something go forward. And the fact that David Medore, Commissioner Medore, had his event there, and it was a nice packed full house with several elected officials, shows that it's still energized. And right now the DOTs saying, well, they just want to see the congestion get worse. Well, poo on them.
No, I have a close. That was Sharon Nassett of Third Bridge Now speaking with KBOO's Henry Leisha about the proposal for a new bridge across the Columbia River.
5 months ago, Governor Kitzhaber ordered a safety preparedness study for the oil trains that are already crisscrossing the state. On Friday, the governor released a report urging the state to charge a fee per rail car transporting oil to fund safety measures that may be necessary in dealing with the transportation of oil. The study also pointed out that the state is currently not prepared to deal with a potential oil train disaster. The study, however, fails to put a dollar amount for the suggested charge per barrel in the report. California has already added a 6.5 cent per barrel fee. The oil trains in question started crossing the Oregon borders in November 2012. A recent oil boom in North Dakota has significantly increased the amount of crude oil traveling across rail lines in the United States, leading to a string of fiery accidents. While railroads are required by federal law to report where they move the North Dakota crude, that same law does not apply to crude moved into Oregon from Utah through the Columbia River Gorge, leaving communities and firefighters unaware of preparations necessary to deal with potential oil disasters. Kitzhaber joined Oregon Senators Wyden and Merkley in asking that the federal law apply to all oil shipments, regardless of origin. He also called for the state of Oregon to hire more rail safety inspectors. A position for a hazardous materials inspector has been available for over 2 years, but has not been filled, despite the fact that the funding for the job has been available. The report blames the Oregon Department of Transportation for that oversight. State rail safety inspectors are paid about $51,000 per year, which is about $17,000 less than a federal inspector doing the same job. The report suggests paying the state inspectors more. For some reason, the railroads have been slow to report to the state officials where the oil spill containment booms are kept, meaning in an emergency, the state will not have any idea where the closest equipment is located. Governor Kitzhaber has set a September deadline for the state fire marshal to catalog stocks of special firefighting foam used for oil fires and other equipment needed to extinguish oil fires. Firefighters across the state have said that if an oil train caught on fire, they do not have enough of the equipment needed to battle the fire and help protect residents and towns along the tracks. Brett Vandenhoevel, executive director of Columbia Riverkeepers, an environmental group, said the state needs to do far more to address oil train safety risks. Vandenhoevel said, "I'm hopeful that we'll see strong actions from the agencies and governor's office. Recommendations alone don't cut it."
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Ken Klippenstein about U.S. weapons supply to Israel, followed by Labor Radio at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline, a view from behind the walls of the U.S. prison system. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is sunny and hot, with a high of 91. The sun and heat is expected to continue throughout the week, so get out your summer gear. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 33 counts per minute in North Portland, 29 counts per minute in Vancouver, Washington. Eugene, Oregon has a count of 33 CPM. Hanford, Washington has a count of 30 CPM. And Vancouver, Washington has a current radiation count of 29 counts per minute. Counts per minute is a measurement of ionizing radiation events registered by an instrument known as a Geiger counter. Radcast alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org. Today in history, on July 28, 1914, World War I began. Following the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne, Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia. Within 1 month, countries across Europe had formed alliances and declared war on other alliances. The quote of the day is from the late South African anti-apartheid leader Nelson Mandela, who said, "We know too well that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians."
It's 5:28. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Have you noticed that the powers that be employ an entirely different standard for measuring the health of America's job market than they use for the stock market? They're currently telling us that the job market is improving. What do they mean? Simply that the economy is generating an increase in the number of jobs available for workers. But when they say the stock market is improving, they don't mean that the number of stocks available to investors is on the rise. Instead, they're measuring the price, the value of the stocks. And isn't value what really counts in both cases? As a worker, you don't merely want to know that 200,000 new jobs are on the market, but what they're worth. Do they pay living wages? Do they come with benefits? Are they just part-time and temporary? Do they include union rights? What are the working conditions, etc.? In other words, are these jobs or scams? So it's interesting that the recent news of job market improvement doesn't mention that of the 10 occupation categories projecting the greatest growth in the next 8 years, only one pays a middle-class wage. Four pay barely above the poverty level, and five pay beneath it, including fast food workers, retail sales staff, health aides, and janitors. The job expected to have the highest number of openings is personal care aide, taking care of aging baby boomers in their houses or in nursing homes. The median salary of an aide is under $20,000. They enjoy no benefits, and about 40% of them must rely on food stamps and Medicaid to make ends meet. Plus, many are in the, quote, shadow economy, vulnerable to being cheated on their already miserly wages. This is Jim Hightower saying, to measure the job market by quantity with no regard for quality, is to devalue workers themselves. Creating 200,000 new jobs is not a sign of economic health if each worker needs two or three of those jobs to patch together a bare-bones living.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
After 6 weeks of negotiation, Congress has agreed on a plan to improve a veterans' health program that has been plagued by long patient waiting times and falsified records. The plan aims to create 27 new clinics, provide more doctors and nurses, and make it easier for veterans to receive outside care if they can't obtain prompt appointments with the VA. Senator Bernie Sanders, the only socialist in the U.S. Congress, spoke to reporters today about the bill.
This VA Conference Committee legislation that we are bringing forward today is far from what I would have written if I had to do it alone, and I suspect it's fair to say it is far from what Chairman Miller would have done if he wrote this bill by himself. It is a compromise legislation. There's been give and take on both sides, and let me be very clear that I strongly support what we have come up with. This bill makes certain that we address the immediate crisis of veterans being forced onto long waiting lines for health care. It strengthens the VA so that it will be able to hire the doctors, nurses, and other medical personnel it needs so that we can put a permanent end to long waiting lists. It addresses the very serious problems of accountability and makes certain that dishonest and incompetent senior officials at the VA do not remain employed there. And in addition, it provides some other significant benefits for veterans and their families. Funding for veterans' needs must be considered a cost of war and appropriated as emergency spending. Planes and tanks and guns are a cost of war. So is taking care of the men and women who use those weapons and who fight our battles. This was the funding mechanism contained in the Sanders-McCain bill, which passed the Senate with 93 votes, and it is the funding mechanism in this bill. Sufficient sums of money must be provided so that the VA has the resources to immediately end unacceptably long waiting periods in many VA facilities throughout the country. This bill does that by contracting out with private medical providers, community health centers, Department of Defense facilities, et cetera, and this is something that was contained in the House bill, and we basically accept that language. This agreement, consistent with the Sanders-McCain bill, allows veterans who live 40 miles or more from the VA facility to get their health care outside of the VA, and I think what we appreciate, if you live 100 miles away and you're sick, you should not have to make that long trip. You should be able to go to a provider in your community. This bill, in terms of dollars, provides some $10 billion for contracting out of health care and for those veterans who live 40 miles or more away, $10 billion. Acting VA Secretary Sloan Gibson and many of the veterans organizations have made it clear that we need to make sure the VA has the doctors, the nurses, the medical personnel, and the space they need. This bill provides $5 billion for the VA to strengthen their capabilities. This legislation, consistent with bills passed in the House, I think unanimously, and in the Senate as part of Sanders-McCain, authorizes funding for the VA to enter into leases at 27 major facilities in 18 states and Puerto Rico. That will cost about $1.5 billion. We have all been outraged by the distortion of data and so forth. This bill contains language which will allow the Secretary to fire people immediately who are doing, who are underperforming or lying. It gives them a 21-day period of appeal without pay during that period. This bill also contains some other provisions included in Sanders-McCain. It improves delivery of care to veterans who experience sexual trauma while serving in the military. It expands the John David Price Scholarship Program to include surviving spouses of members of the armed forces who died in the line of duty, and it also lets all veterans qualify for in-state tuition under the post-9/11 GI Bill. and it also extends the program regarding TBI.
That was Senator Bernie Sanders speaking today at the U.S. Capitol about a bill passed today to reform the Veterans Administration.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Detroit's bankruptcy trial begins August 14th. Detroit retired and active city workers voted to accept pension cuts of 4.5% plus loss of cost of living increases because even heavier cuts were possible if they voted against these cuts. Their pensions average $19,000 to $20,000 a year. Police and firefighters voted to accept losing part of their pension cost of living raises. Police and fire pensions in Detroit average $32,000 a year. The federal bankruptcy seeks to eliminate or drastically cut $18 billion in debt. The pension cuts are being forced on Detroit workers, even though the state constitution says that public worker pensions can't be cut. The federal bankruptcy judge ruled that federal bankruptcy law trumps that state pensions cut prohibition. Michigan's attorney general has publicly said he disagrees with the judge's ruling, but he's not using his office to legally challenge the ruling. U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin agrees with the AFGE, the union representing frontline Veterans Affairs caregivers, that staffing shortages are a big reason why so many veterans have such long waits for health care. Senator Baldwin has introduced a bill to increase VA staffing.
The reason for the long waits is that the VA in some areas is woefully understaffed. There are not enough physicians and other health care providers for the very significant needs that our veterans present today. The bill that I've introduced tries to essentially leverage greater health care availability in the VA by permitting the veterans' health services to hire more medical residents.
The Medicare Trust Fund is solvent until 2030, 4 years longer than was projected last year. The trustees' report released Monday cited the Affordable Care Act and its various cost savings reforms as a major contributing factor to the longer solvency for Medicare. The report says the health care law known as Obamacare included provisions aimed at reducing costs, increasing revenues, and combating fraud and abuse. A new study published in the New England Journal of Medicine estimates that over 10 million adults gained health insurance due to the Affordable Care Act. States that expanded Medicaid under the health care reform law saw significant coverage gains for low-income people 18 to 64 years old. The study found similar results to one by Gallup and the estimates from the Congressional Budget Office.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
General Mills has announced that it will implement measures to cut greenhouse gas emissions from its supply chains and will press for political action to address climate change. The announcement comes after more than 230,000 people signed petitions and took action as a part of Oxfam's campaign to urge food and beverage companies to help stop climate change. General Mills is the maker of Cheerios, Häagen-Dazs, and Green Giant, and is one of the world's 10 biggest food and beverage companies. The commitments announced today make it the first major food and beverage company to promise to implement long-term science-based targets to cut emissions. The company has also signed on to the Climate Declaration and joined Business for Innovative Climate and Energy Policy, known by its acronym BICEP. Oxfam said today that today's announcement by General Mills provides further evidence that consumers can really change how companies operate if they will raise their voices. The company has agreed to define and disclose a total supply chain greenhouse gas reduction target. It will also aim to achieve zero net deforestation in high-risk supply chains by 2020 and disclose its top three suppliers of palm oil and sugarcane.
And now we turn to our friends at National Native News for the latest headlines from a Native American perspective.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In New Mexico, people gathered Friday at the Albuquerque Indian Center to rally for peace and remember two homeless men recently killed in the city. Many made posters which expressed their feelings.
I wrote that sign, you know, how many more natives does it take to be murdered before this city snaps that it is a hate crime towards our people? And then another sign I wrote says Diné Pride, which means Navajo pride. Then it says, we will forgive, but we will never forget.
That's Roylyn Trujillo, who says he's lived on the streets before and says violence against homeless native people is not a new problem. He came to the event with his grandkids to teach them tolerance.
The homeless people are like afraid to speak up. They're afraid of the police. It's because, you know, we're afraid of just getting thrown in for no reason, arrested for no reason. And that's why they're afraid to go up to the police and ask for help.
With a hand drum, the U.S. and New Mexico flags, a banner reading Great Spirit Hear Us, and posters in hand, more than 100 people left the Indian Center and marched down the street, including Albuquerque resident Nance Crow.
I am appalled by the violence against people who are homeless, but particularly people who were here first. And I think it's just awful, and I want everyone to know that we should be much more respectful and caring about each other.
The victims beaten to death were identified as Allison Gorman and Key Thompson, both Navajo. Navajo officials recently met with city leaders to address the indigent Native population. City Councilor Ray Garduño marched with the Indian community and says he'd like to see such acts prosecuted as a hate crime.
In this case, certainly should be lifted up as a group that needs to be protected, especially those folks who find themselves away from their homes in a foreign place, although it's theirs to begin with, but make sure that they feel not only comfortable and welcome, but safe, primarily because there is this sense that grows between people, that it's us and them. And that's the worst thing we can foster.
Albuquerque Indian Center President Cayudas Tecumseh agrees that more needs to be done to help the number of homeless Native Americans in Albuquerque who come and go from the city. He says the number is high according to previous surveys.
Indian people tend to be invisible to the public at large, and which is a shame. And that is why we need to continue to have the Albuquerque Indian Center to work with and for Indian people.
A memorial service for the victims was also held over the weekend. Three teenagers have been charged with their murder.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
The Ebola epidemic hitting Western Sub-Saharan Africa continues to grow, spiraling out of control as governments scramble to implement strategies to combat the emerging pandemic. The International Medical Organization, Doctors Without Borders, has labeled the epidemic officially as out of control. Over 650 deaths have been reported since the current outbreak started in February of this year. International healthcare specialists believe many more deaths have occurred beyond the 650 confirmed, as the official death count only includes those that died in hospital and tested positive for the disease. A prominent doctor in Liberia leading his country's response to the epidemic has died, and two United States aid workers have contracted the disease despite stringent safety precautions. Currently, cases have been reported in Nigeria, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. Liberia has responded by closing all border crossings except airports, where specialists test all incoming travelers. Making the fight against the disease especially hard are suspicions by the local population that witch doctors or healthcare workers are causing the disease. There have been multiple reported cases of patients being forcefully broken out of hospital isolation wards by large crowds. First identified in 1976 in Sudan, Ebola causes fever, kidney and liver damage, and leads to massive internal bleeding, soon followed by death. The highly contagious Ebola virus is spread through contact with pigs, sheep, fruit bats, and infected humans. An entire funeral party contracted the disease, showing the ease with which the disease can spread. The current epidemic has a death rate of around 75%. There is no known vaccine.
In a new release from the Edward Snowden files, journalist Glenn Greenwald has reported that the United States NSA has been actively spying on political dissidents and human rights activists in Saudi Arabia and sharing that information with the Saudi government. According to files released by Edward Snowden, the new policy was developed in 2012 by James Clapper and the Obama administration to help the Saudi government control political and religious dissent. The Snowden documents show that from 1991 until the new policy was developed in 2012, the NSA gave very little support to the Saudi government. Many human rights activists label Saudi Arabia as one of the most brutal and oppressive governments in the world. While the U.S. State Department has reported on the human rights abuses by the Saudi government, the Snowden documents reveal that the NSA was at the same time directly providing electronic eavesdropping support and surveillance against protesters and human rights activists and attorneys. The increased flow of information from the NSA has led Saudi Arabia to greatly increase its crackdown on dissidents in the last few years. The Saudi Arabian government has been called by the U.S. government one of the foremost strategically important countries in the world for regime continuity. Meanwhile, at least three congressmen are calling for the U.S. to release 28 previously redacted pages from the official 9/11 report on Saudi involvement and financing of the 9/11 terror plot. Earlier this month, a bipartisan resolution was introduced in Congress asking President Obama to release the 28 pages of the 9/11 report previously redacted by the Bush administration. In fact, one former senator has come out and stated that the Saudi government, without question, was supporting the hijackers. The Obama administration has refused to discuss either the 9/11 report or the new NSA allegations.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Zur, Henry Leisha, Rosalind Scott, and Ken Jones. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, At 7, it's Democracy Now! With journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on the Abe and Joe Show, we'll take your call, so tune in and speak up. At 9 on Alternative Radio, Vandana Shiva speaks on seeds and freedom. 10,000 years ago, Iraq, Egypt, and India were the sites of the earliest harvesting of plants that had previously been gathered in the wild. Since then, humans have been able to grow food and feed themselves. Today, according to Vandana Shiva, that freedom embodied in seeds is threatened by multinational corporations such as Monsanto. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on stage and studio, host Dee Mae Roberts presents her 1989 Peabody Award-winning documentary, May May, A Daughter's Song. The piece chronicles Dee Mae and her mother, Chu Yin, telling the story of a conflicted daughter and a mother who suffered abuse, starvation, and the horrors of World War II. Thanks for listening to KBOO Radio, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for an interview conducted by KBOO's Jenka Soderberg about U.S. arms exports to Israel and the role of these arms in the current offensive in Gaza. Good night, Rosalyn.
Good night, Ken. And good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Can you start by telling us about what are some of the weapons that are being used in Gaza that have been supplied by the U.S.?
Turns out, unfortunately, that the weapons being used on Gaza, what we have are categories. Categories are what's publicly available. People that ship the weapons over can file for confidentiality, so it is difficult to know specifically what weapons they're sending. What we do know is that they're sending fighter jets, attack helicopters, and tanks, all of which are being used in either the occupation or the bombing of Gaza. What we do know is that a lot of the companies involved are based in the U.S. I would guess companies like Boeing, Raytheon, you know, the usual suspects.
How are these weapons being used in violation of U.S. law, particularly the U.S. Arms Export Control Act?
Well, the U.S. Arms Export Control Act states that the U.S. cannot be exporting weapons to a government that is potentially guilty of international law violations. And so I spoke to the U.N. Rapporteur for the Palestinian territories, and he said that he finds, his name is Richard Falk. You can look up the interview online. He says it seems very likely that Israel is violating international rights standards and that they may indeed be guilty of war crimes. In fact, the UN voted a couple days ago to have a formal inquiry into whether or not Israel has committed war crimes in Gaza, and the U.S. was the only member nation that voted against that resolution, that voted against having that inquiry, in addition to Israel, of course.
Does it appear that that there are indications that Israel has violated international law and has engaged in war crimes in Gaza?
Yes. They've been bombing UN facilities where people are trying to find shelter in. So they've bombed UN schools. They've bombed ambulances. They've the recent figures suggest they've killed about 70% of the people in Gaza that Israel has killed have not, in fact, been militants. They've been civilians. And they've also blocked off exit for refugees that might be seeking medical attention, which also violates international law.
The U.S. does supply military aid to Egypt, which is currently assisting Israel in the assault on Gaza.
Exactly. That's actually a big problem. There's a border between Gaza and Egypt. It's called the Rafah border. In the past, when Israel has attacked Egypt, this border has been very important for Gazans who want to leave the area for to seek refuge during the bombing and also to find medical treatment, because medicines can become in quite short supply in Gaza for various reasons. But what the new Egyptian government, which actually came to power after a coup, what the new Egyptian government has done is they've blocked off this border. And so it makes it so that many Palestinians who are trying to seek refuge can't do so anymore. In fact, they're finding that tens of thousands of Palestinians have taken up refuge to the point that they've run out of space to be keeping them in there. So it's a big problem that they've closed the Rafah border, that Egypt has closed the Rafah border.
And let's get back to military aid that the U.S. supplies. You said that it's kind of hard to say what companies are involved, but how much money are we talking about that the U.S. actually spends on military aid that goes to Israel?
What is formally called military aid is at least $3 billion a year, but those figures are often vastly understated. In a piece I wrote on the topic recently, I interviewed an arms specialist who actually was involved in some in regulating arms formerly in the South African government. And what he said is that these formal figures, like $3 billion a year that the U.S. provides, does not include all sorts of other things that either pass by under different sorts of designations. So, say, there are also millions and millions going towards the missile defense program in Israel. A lot of things that just might not even be on the books. A lot of what the Pentagon does is actually what's called black budget, where we don't get to see a lot of the figures. So it can make it difficult to come up with much more than just a minimal estimate.
Well, and I understand the U.S. Congress, in the midst of this latest aggression in Gaza, has approved a $200 million added funding for the Iron Dome missile defense system in Israel.
Yes, I believe that's correct. One of the big controversies about the Iron Dome is that if you listen, there's actually an MIT professor who's been putting out some studies based on it, and what they find is that it only succeeds in knocking out about 5% of the missiles. And when it does so, it actually can be more dangerous, because when it hits the missile, then it creates a sort of shrapnel effect where the pieces of the missile land, and that can be more dangerous than the missiles themselves, because the missiles that are coming out of Gaza are actually pretty primitive in nature, so they don't tend to be so dangerous. And so for that reason, I think that kind of underscores the sort of convoluted nature of military aid. Although it may be called defense, this may just be some kind of business contract that might be agreeable to both sides. Because if you actually look at the hard information on it, it doesn't seem to be a very effective form of defense.
What's the impact on U.S. involvement in the attempts to negotiate a ceasefire when the U.S. government is so heavily involved in funding one side of this conflict?
I think you bring up a good point, because if the U.S. really wanted a ceasefire, what they could do is stop sending aid. Israel is a relatively small economy relative to the U.S. Their economy is about about $300 billion. By comparison, the U.S. economy is $16 trillion. And so Israel vitally depends on countries like the U.S. for its economic vitality. I believe that if the U.S. stopped sending aid for its various technological programs like the Iron Dome, or even just military aid, it's hard to believe that Israel wouldn't back down, given how much they rely on the U.S. for this kind of support. And when the U.S. says that it wants to initiate a ceasefire, Hamas has been very clear about what their ceasefire requirements are. The main ones are ending the siege of Gaza that Israel has implemented, and then the other one is ending the occupation of Gaza. According to the according to a senior official at the Palestinian Authority, he says that about 50% of Gaza is currently under occupation. And so a ceasefire is going to be pretty short-lived unless they withdraw troops, which, if you look at the most recent U.S. proposal for a ceasefire, it doesn't actually require Israel to withdraw from Gaza.
So the Israeli government's claims that they disengaged from Gaza in 2005 and that has not been under occupation since then are not actually correct.
They are under a military siege, and right now they're under occupation because of the conflict. But the siege makes it so that they can't get crucial goods to flow through the borders that they would have before. There are shortages of medicine, there's shortages of gasoline, there's shortages of just the real building blocks of like a functioning state economy. And that's a consequence of a naval blockade on the coast of Gaza, and also the blockade between Egypt and there, and then the blockade that Israel is imposing on them.
Well, and Gaza is not a sovereign nation. It is under Israeli occupation. It's an occupied territory, one of the two occupied territories. And as such, Israel is required to carry out certain requirements as an occupying power. Is there a chance that this occupation could end as a result of the conflict in Gaza that's going on right now? Or is that occupation set to continue?
I think a lot of that depends crucially on the level of protest and dissent that occurs within both Israel and, I think, more importantly, within the U.S. Once again, looking at the contrast in relative military and economic might of Israel and the U.S., I believe that if protest was sufficiently vocalized in the U.S. and they managed to cut off some measure of aid to Israel, I think Israel would respond.
Are there any efforts at an international level to get a ceasefire that would actually lead to Israeli withdrawal from Gaza?
It seems unlikely because the U.S., in many cases, whenever the Security Council, and the Security Council can issue resolutions that are backed up by force, and so they sort of have to be listened to. But the way the U.N. is set up, the U.S. has veto authority over any decision that the U.N. Security Council makes.